Chapter 14. The Walk of Faith. For we walk by faith, not by sight. 2 Corinthians 5:7. Who also walk in the steps of faith, which our father Abraham had. Romans 4:12. Trust in the Lord with all your heart, and lean not on your own understanding. Proverbs 3:5. What is faith? To hear atheists define it, one would get the impression that the faith of Christians is a gratuitous acceptance of irrational propositions for which no evidence exists. In a debate between the atheist Richard Dawkins and the Christian John Lennox, Dawkins tried to push this definition of the word. Footnote. We must assume that Dawkins made up this definition, since it corresponds with no definition known to Christianity, nor to any Hebrew, Greek, or English dictionaries. End footnote. Asserting, we only need to use the word faith when there isn't any evidence. Lennox responded, I presume you have faith in your wife. Is there any evidence for that? Yes, plenty of evidence, said the atheist, not realizing his mistake. The laughter of the crowd indicated that the contradiction had not been lost on them. Dawkins had thought faith was about believing alleged facts, for which no evidence exists. Lennox pointed out that faith can be trusting, or placing confidence in someone, for whose credibility there may be a very great deal of evidence. It would certainly be irrational to place confidence in a person who has provided no evidence of his or her trustworthiness. But it is a different matter with those who have given abundant evidence for their personal integrity. Dawkins counts his wife to be such a person, and we have no reason to doubt his assessment. It is true that faith exists where absolute proof is lacking, but lack of proof is not the same thing as lack of evidence. We can obtain absolute proof of very few things, but everyone holds numerous unprovable convictions which rest upon excellent evidence. Both sides of the God debate have to consider the available evidence and reach their respective conclusions based upon rational extrapolation. The same is true of a man's quote-unquote faith in his wife. His confidence in her may be quite justified by evidence, though there is no absolute proof that she will always be trustworthy. It is on the same basis that we trust or distrust a surgeon, an airline pilot, or a politician soliciting our vote. We may feel that we have evidence of their competence and goodwill, but the evidence can hardly amount to undeniable proof. In the end, the conviction that a competent man or woman ought to be trusted comes down to an assessment of the character of one who we feel has earned our confidence and has done nothing to earn distrust. The faith of the disciple of Jesus is placed in God, who is both omniscient and truthful. Gullibility is not faith. No doubt there are individuals who believe whatever they are told and who accept the idea that there is a God without regard to any evidence. However, this is not the way that the people in the Bible nor intelligent Christians through the ages have arrived at their belief in God. If a person is irrational, he or she may, with equal disregard for evidence, choose between atheism, Christianity, or any other faith system. No intelligent Christian would recommend such an approach, nor does the Bible. The Scriptures do not encourage a blind or irrational faith. They present abundant reasons for trusting a God who cannot lie and who never fails to keep his promises. This is not the place to enter into a polemic concerning God's existence. That is a discussion for novices whose exploration of the topic is at a more elementary stage than that of my assumed reader. Footnote. Feel free to call my radio program to engage in that discussion, www.thenarrowpath.com. End footnote. Having considered the best evidences available that God is there, that he is faithful, and that the Scriptures contain his true words, we are ready to embark on the walk of faith. We will assume for our discussion a definition of faith more in line with the dictionaries and with scriptural usage than the one suggested by Dawkins. To the believer, faith is a persuasion, a conviction, and a settled confidence in God. To have faith is to believe and trust God, demonstrated by resting in his faithful character, following and obeying him with confidence. Hebrews 11 is a great chapter illustrating what such a faith looks like when lived out in those who possess it. At the outset, we are told that faith is that which provides assurance of things that have been promised, as well as providing knowledge of the unseen realm. In this respect, all people have more faith than they know. If you are persuaded that lands like Madagascar or Papua New Guinea exist without having been to either place, then they belong to the unseen realm, in your case. The only way you know about them is by faith, that is, by trusting books, magazines, maps, documentaries and such, by people whom you regard to be reliable witnesses. The same is true about your knowledge of any historical events that occurred before you were born, or in places where you could not witness them. Even Richard Dawkins has faith in many scientific theorems, grand-scale evolution for one, which neither he nor any human has ever observed. To accept as true something that one has never observed, nor personally proven to be true, is to exercise faith. Not only does everyone have faith, but we could not function without it. When I drive down the street, I do not know that other drivers are not intending to smash into my car, but if I did not trust them in this matter, I could never drive on the public roads. If I trusted no one concerning things I am not able to prove, I would never know whether the food served to me had been poisoned, whether the captain of the airliner has chosen this flight for his spectacular suicide, or whether the pharmacist has given me a substance that is safe to ingest. We actually trust people more than we realize, and do so every day. Christians are not unique in this respect, except that they put their confidence in God and Christ, both of whom have given abundant evidence of their trustworthiness. After trusting flawed humans on a daily basis, it is a small matter to be able to trust in a God who never lies. If we receive the witness of men, the witness of God is greater. After providing his helpful definition of faith, the writer of Hebrews catalogs, by way of Old Testament examples, a number of both visible and invisible results in the life of the believer, which testify to the presence of such faith in God. It provides assurance of that which cannot be seen as surely as sight does of the visible realm. It is manifested in one's obedience to God. It is often rewarded with divine deliverance and victory in danger. It inspires steadfastness under trial when such deliverance does not come, and most importantly, it pleases God, resulting in his approval. In Hebrews 11, there are no examples provided of people who had this kind of faith and either did nothing about it or experienced no special assistance from God. None of the examples describe faith as a quiet, privately held, secret set of beliefs. Abraham's faith is especially featured because he is often held up as the prototype of the believer justified by faith like ourselves. In Hebrews 11, Abraham's faith is described thus: "By faith Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out to the place which he would receive as an inheritance, and he went out, not knowing where he was going. By faith he dwelt in the land of promise as in a foreign country, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise." Abram, as he was called at that time, was apparently a wealthy man in Ur of the Chaldees, Babylonia, when God first called him to leave his home and travel without a known destination. Because he believed Yahweh's promise, he left his family home on God's errand. We might think this a small matter. Didn't all those old Middle Eastern guys live nomadic lives like the Bedouins of today? Some did. But Abraham was a cosmopolitan man living in or near a very settled and civilized city in Babylonia about which today's archaeologists know a great deal. He did, in fact, become a nomadic chieftain as a result of God's call, but it was a sacrifice for him to change his life in this way. The statement in Hebrews probably suggests that the life he had left was not in a tent, but in a house. For him, the sacrifice would be no less than it would be for any established city dweller to become a homeless wanderer with no set destination in mind. Abram didn't take his steps of faith in one giant leap, though he should have. He moved to another village called Haran, closer to the promised land, and settled there until his father's death. Only after his father died did Abram fully obey the call, but when he did, he cut all ties to the past. He was 75 when he came to Canaan, and he lived there in a tent for the next 100 years. It seems he never owned a house in the Promised Land. Footnote: he is seen as living in a tent throughout his life in the land. References throughout the story to Abraham's quote-unquote house appear to be references to his household, comprised of his family and servants, not his domicile. End footnote. Abraham lived a life of faith in Yahweh. It is likely most accurate to see his faith as a maturing phenomenon, as with most believers, which was punctuated by occasions of doubt. At one point, God promised Abraham that his wife, who had always been barren and was now past childbearing age, would give him a son named Isaac. While Abraham and Sarah, his wife, both laughed in disbelief when they first heard this promise, footnote, Hebrews 11:11. Translators disagree as to whether this is a statement about Sarah's faith or Abraham's in the face of Sarah's barrenness. End footnote. They soon fully put their trust in God's promise. Of Sarah, we are told, by faith Sarah herself also received strength to conceive seed, and she bore a child when she was past the age, because she judged him faithful who had promised. Notice that the writer sees faith as a judgment one makes of God's character. Sarah believed because she judged him faithful. When I was a child, I wondered, why is God so concerned that people would believe in him? This now is easy to answer. How do you feel when you earnestly try to get important information across to someone and they say, I don't believe you? Aren't they calling you a liar? To believe what God says is to reasonably judge that he is faithful. John plainly identifies the only alternative to trusting God. He who does not believe God has made him a liar. 1 John 5:10. A settled faith or confidence in God exists as an outgrowth of perceiving him as he really is. He is a God who cannot lie. His understanding is unlimited. He cannot make a mistake. He is omnicompetent, so that he cannot fail to do the thing he promises to do. He is love, so he can never choose anything but the very best for his children. Faith recognizes these things and finds such a one impossible to distrust. To disbelieve God is to judge him, without warrant, as being unreliable and dishonest. Thus, faith is not some mystical quality that some people are fortunate to possess while others are consigned to live in doubt and insecurity. Having faith boils down to this: choosing to make a positive judgment as opposed to a negative one of the very character of God. If you lack faith, you are not a victim of little faith, someone who has been denied something that has been given to others. Rather, if you lack faith, you are simply someone who is gratuitously, perhaps unknowingly, insulting God's character and calling him a liar. This is something you can stop doing at will, and the sooner the better. In praising Abraham's faith and God's promise of a son, Paul waxes verbose. And not being weak in faith, he did not consider his own body, already dead since he was about 100 years old, and the deadness of Sarah's womb. He did not waver at the promise of God through unbelief, but was strengthened in faith, giving glory to God, and being fully convinced that what he had promised he was also able to perform, and therefore it was accounted to him for righteousness. Paul sees Abraham's faith to be a persuasion, a being convinced that God is able to keep his promises. This conviction inspired Abraham to change the trajectory of his whole life, reshaping his perception of his destiny and his purpose for living. This life-altering quality in his faith is actually said to be the reason that his faith was counted to him as righteousness. Therefore, it was accounted to him for righteousness. The word therefore clearly means because of this. Because Abraham's faith had such a life-changing impact upon him, he was counted as righteous by God. If we are assuming that a faith which makes no change in our lives will be accounted to us for righteousness, we will find no support from Paul. Nearer the end of his life, Abraham's faith was tested by the command to sacrifice his son. Of course, God does not approve of human sacrifices and would never have allowed Abraham to go through with it, but Abraham did not know this. He had no Bible and only knew of God's faithful character from his own limited experience of him. Therefore, it was a true test of his faith, because there were as yet unfulfilled promises of God concerning Isaac's offspring, and Isaac was at this time unmarried and childless. the writer of Hebrews recalls, "By faith Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac, and he who had received the promises offered up his only begotten son, of whom it was said, 'In Isaac your seed shall be called,' concluding that God was able to raise him up, even from the dead." We who believe the Bible look back upon a history where a number of people, Christ and others in both testaments, have been raised from death. Even so, we would have difficulty in trusting that any given person we have known and who has died will be raised to life again prior to the final resurrection. Abraham had no such history to look back upon. There were no precedents for God raising the dead. He had never heard of such a phenomenon. Yet, since God's promises could not be fulfilled with Isaac dead, and Abraham fully intended to carry out the sacrifice as ordered, Abraham concluded that it would be necessary for God to raise Isaac in order to fulfill his other promises. The faith it would require to go through with such a thing could only be found in one who had learned that God is completely faithful and good, and should be obeyed in all matters. Paul describes those who are saved today as those who walk in the steps of faith which our father Abraham had. Abraham walked and lived by faith. What does that look like in the lives of modern disciples? Living by faith. The Bible contains primarily two kinds of material. One, truths to be believed, and two, commands to be obeyed. Footnote: this does not exhaust every category of the contents, but certainly the vast majority. End footnote. Examples of the first category would be the statements affirming the goodness, love, and omnipotence of God. Examples of the second would be instructions forbidding us to worry about tomorrow, commanding that we forgive our enemies, abstain from worldly lusts that war against the soul, etc. Sometimes Paul's letters, for example Ephesians and Colossians, are equally divided into these two categories. The first type of statements forms a foundation for the second type. That is, because of the truths that are affirmed, we safely can and must do the things commanded. The only reason anyone would disobey God, it seems, would be one's failure to believe his promises. If I choose a carnal and disobedient lifestyle, it can only be because I do not believe the biblical statements that such a choice leads to death and grief, and that a life of obedience is one of surpassing peace and joy. If I do not forgive my enemy, I must believe that this is not the wisest and best policy, regardless what God commands. If I worry about tomorrow, I can hardly be trusting his promised commitment and ability to turn everything for the good of those who obey and trust him. The believer does not only accept God's assertions as facts, but also lives his or her life counting on those facts being true, by obeying God without fear or insecurity. Therefore, the walk of faith simply means living as if God and his word are faithful, the only sensible course, since they are. Prayer and action. The whole walk of faith presupposes a life of prayer. Faith is not a vague optimism that good things will manifest under the smile of the universe due to the mystical power of positive thinking. Genuine faith always has an object in whom its confidence rests. In the case of the believer, it involves an interactive relationship with a faithful creator and provider. Through the overflowing generosity of God, many blessings come to people whether they pray for them or not. However, God's way with his own people is interactive, involving our asking and his response. There are things he will do and provide if asked, which will not be done if we do not pray. You do not have because you do not ask. Prayer is an acknowledgement of human impotence and dependence. It is the child's expression of faith in the Father. It keeps us in touch with him, as would not be the case if every blessing simply was granted unilaterally without being requested. God is pleased to meet every need of his children who ask and trust him. Prayer does not replace effort and responsible action, but it must accompany and direct such action. While I trust God for my daily bread, I must still consider that he may provide this through my diligence and labor in earning a living. We must trust God for our health and longevity, but not when we are neglecting his instructions or irresponsibly stewarding our bodies. We entrust our children to God's care, but we must not neglect our duty to nurture and protect them from harm. We know that when we have done all that we can do in the will of God, there remains more to be done, which only God can do. This is especially true with regard to our efforts to promote the kingdom of God. Every effort and every concern for which we labor should be accompanied by prayer. In everything by prayer and supplication, with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God. Faith and foolishness. It is never foolish to trust in one who can and will reliably deliver on his promises. However, it is possible to mistake our own assumptions for promises of God. For example, there are those who believe that God has promised to miraculously heal every sickness for those who have sufficient faith. It is often assumed by such people that obtaining medical assistance when they are sick would exhibit a lack of faith in God, dishonoring his promises, and possibly disqualifying themselves for divine healing. For this reason, many have died unnecessarily who misplaced their quote-unquote faith in this fantasy. There is no promise of God in Scripture that can responsibly be interpreted to guarantee that all who have enough faith will be healed. Biblical faith is not wishful or uninformed thinking. On the other hand, many people seem obsessed with self-preservation. They look to doctors as to gods, believing that the prolongation of life is uniquely in their power. In such an age of placing confidence in medical experts, one is often regarded as foolish when not uncritically trusting and depending upon the doctor. In the 2020 coronavirus pandemic, the world economy was brought to the edge of total disaster due to the gross miscalculations and mistaken predictions of some of the world's most trusted medical experts. Consultation with physicians and following their instructions can be entirely compatible with trusting in God, just as taking expert financial advice can be compatible with trusting God for finances. God can provide and protect, with or without such assistance, according to his specific will in a given case. He has provided natural resources and opportunities to promote human health and well-being, but to face a desperately deadly condition or to meet an impossibly large expense without using natural means would leave supernatural alternatives as the sole option. Miraculous interventions are not unknown, but they should not be presumed upon simply because we prefer them. Presumption is not faith, since faith comes by hearing, and hearing by the word of God. If we have either the promise or the command of God requiring something of us, which cannot naturally be accomplished, then to expect supernatural assistance is true faith. Otherwise, it is presumption. Medical science does not have all the answers, and some of the answers that they do have may carry ethical or moral baggage to which a Christian would object. Obviously, to receive organs for transplant which have been harvested from healthy aborted babies or from living prisoners in Chinese prisons would be objectionable to a disciple of Jesus upon moral grounds. The believer who would choose to die rather than to receive such an organ transplant would be seen as foolish by the atheist, but as a hero by those who value a Christian conscience, as God does. Christians might reasonably decline to be kept alive indefinitely by artificial means and at great cost to relatives or taxpayers when their conditions strongly suggest that God's chosen time for their inevitable appointment has arrived. A person dying of cancer might ethically choose to decline certain elective treatments which cannot promise to heal, which are grossly invasive, or can only briefly prolong a degraded quality of life. There certainly are reasonable occasions for a believer to question or reject medical recommendations. Believers know that God can legitimately use the skills of a physician to promote healing. Jesus said as much, Matthew 9:12. But they also know that their life and well-being are ultimately in the hands of God, not the medical professional. The use of such assistance must be subject to the dictates of one's conscience before God. A medical option may be God's means to heal and prolong life, but our trust is not in the method, but in God, and our chief concern is not for long life, but for the will of God to be done. To the unbeliever, the entire enterprise of a life of faith appears foolish. For those who have no other life to anticipate, there is no higher value than earthly longevity. For the believer, death is not the ultimate tragedy, but an inevitable appointment each of us must keep according to the will of God. The ultimate tragedy is not to die, but to die unprepared to meet God. It is not foolish to trust in God's actual promises. Nor is it foolish to accept what some would regard a premature death because it was unavoidable in the course of obedience to God. Job said, "Though he slay me, yet I will trust him." If a person dies on the field of battle out of loyalty to the homeland, that one is feted as a hero. By contrast, if someone dies in the course of obediently trusting God in a dangerous missionary venture, even many religious people will consider that one a fool. One such martyr memorably answered such thinking with his immortal riposte, "He is no fool who gives what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose." Jim Elliot, in the Journals of Jim Elliot, entry October 28, 1949. This is little more than a paraphrase of Jesus' own words. "Whoever desires to save his life," meaning through cowardice or compromise, "will lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake will find it." The Promises of God. Obedience to Christ is the most secure course of life in the world. In days of social chaos, pandemics, terrorism, tyrannical rulers, and international hostilities, many wonder where they might find a secure place for themselves and their families. Some consider relocation to safer regions. Others have stocked up bunkers or have bug-out plans in place. Given the global and universal nature of the factors that potentially threaten the liberty or safety of every person, none of these options can really be viewed with complete confidence or a sense of absolute security. Historically, it has not been unknown for God to instruct his people in danger to flee to safety, and one should do so when thus instructed. The wise believer knows that the safest place on the planet is in the center of the will of God, whether in a secure place or under martial law, in a gulag, or amid social turmoil. The believer has a secret weapon against all insecurity, a faithful Father who has made unassailable promises. "Deliver me, O Lord, from mine enemies. I flee unto thee to hide me." He who dwells in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty. I will say of the Lord, "He is my refuge and my fortress, my God, in him I will trust." Psalm 91, verses 1 to 2. Some people speak of claiming the promises. This is a phrase not found in Scripture, though the Scriptures do record prayers of the godly which contain reminders to God that he had said certain things that they were counting upon. Talking about claiming the promises, while valid, sometimes carries the tone of one demanding that to which one believes he or she is entitled. I think the walk of faith is better described as resting in the promises. That is, rather than coming to God with demands that he must do what we think he promised to do, we simply take it as a given that he is faithful, and his promises provide a firm foundation for a life surrendered to his will. In returning and rest, you shall be saved. In quietness and confidence shall be your strength. One who counts on such promises is not thereby prevented from taking precautions. One may wisely feel God wishes for him to take safeguards against future contingencies, as God led Noah to build an ark, and Joseph to store up grain against a coming famine. Solomon said, "A prudent man foresees evil and hides himself, but the simple pass on and are punished." We may take every step that wisdom may dictate within the will of God, but we should constantly check our hearts to be sure that our confidence is not in anything but God himself. Faith is not the opposite of preparation. It is the opposite of insecurity, anxiety, and worry. God has given promises covering every contingency. He has promised to provide food and clothing, safety from outward dangers, guidance, and of course his own presence in trials. These are promises that pertain to this life. There are also promises that pertain to eternity. This distinction between the temporal and the eternal is important to bear in mind, because this life is impermanent, and promises concerning this life pertain only to the time span of our appointed days. For example, Jesus said we needn't worry about food, because God feeds the sparrows, who are far less valuable to God than we are. The cynical person may point out, "Yes, God does feed the sparrows, but they have been known to die of starvation, or of exposure to the elements, or by predators. This is quite true, and needs to be factored into our understanding of God's promises concerning temporal things. These promises apply only until death, which occurs whenever God chooses. Sparrows do die, and so do we. But Jesus said that not one sparrow falls to the ground apart from your Father's will. The disciple of Jesus is obsessed with the will of God, not with earthly longevity. One should be less concerned about dying than about surviving apart from your Father's will. Dying is inevitable, but Jesus assures us that, for one trusting in God's care, dying apart from God's will is impossible. God's various promises assure us that we will not starve, that our enemies will not permanently harm us, and that we will never lack any good thing. This should be understood to mean, these things are all true until they are no longer relevant. When God is finished with me in this life, the time will come when his promises to preserve this temporal life will expire and will be replaced with something which is far better. If God is finished with us here and has nothing left for us to accomplish for him, what possible reason could exist for wishing to live another day in this vale of tears? Is it that I wish to see my grandchildren and great-grandchildren? As understandable as such desires may be, doesn't God know as well as I do whether my living to see such things is for the better or the worse? The walk of faith happily leaves all such decisions in the hands of God. God always gives his best to those who leave the choice with him. Jim Elliott.